Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we all know that feeling happy makes us smile, but can smiling make us happy? The reverse of that, you know, you've been told this probably or read this somewhere. You don't feel really great, just smile and it will kind of change your mood. Well, we're going to explore that and other sort of pop psychology ideas that have been portrayed in the media over the years and really taken root with a University of Iowa psychologist when we come back in the second half hour. But first in the half hour, not a smile, probably a grimace. I don't know. What would be the expression for those who are seeking insurance during this time of Affordable Care Act open enrollment? It started yesterday, runs through December 15th. Of course, we have that political fight over the future of what's also called Obamacare. That continues. This half hour, we want to put that aside to the extent that we can and see what those seeking health insurance on the Affordable Care Act marketplace can expect. So listeners, this is a great chance for you, if you're seeking insurance at the beginning of this enrollment period, to ask your questions. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Nicole Cook is with us. She is a navigator with Visiting Nurse Services of Iowa. And navigators are individuals who are trained and able to help consumers, small businesses, their employees as they look for health coverage options through the marketplace. An important note, they are required to be unbiased. They are built into the Affordable Care Act, so to speak. Nicole Cook, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk, and we're going to talk in a moment with a couple of Iowans who are seeking their insurance. Broadly speaking, what has changed to impact those enrolling this time?
The big changes to the individual marketplace or healthcare.gov this year are the changes in the local insurers. In previous years, we've had multiple insurance companies represented on the marketplace. And this year, for 2018, Medica is going to be the only insurer on the marketplace. So that's one big change that folks are hearing about and asking about. Secondly, the other sort of hot topic in this area are the increases in premiums that people are really concerned about. And so that's another change that people are worried about. What I can tell you in regards to that issue, the increase in premiums, is that if you had a marketplace plan last year and received the subsidies or the tax credits available on the marketplace and are looking at the marketplace again this year and have had little change in income, it's very likely that you will receive the same subsidies again this year. And oftentimes what we're seeing this year is that those subsidies are really making up the difference for those folks in terms of the premium increases. So that isn't really affecting those individuals as much, as long as they're receiving a subsidy.
In fact, let me quote from a USA Today article. It said here, for 2018, 80% of the people can find a plan for under $75 each month, thanks to financial assistance. That's up from 71% last year. 80% this year, 71% last year. So, in fact, explain that actually some people will be in, or what, more people will be in a better position in a certain way?
That appears to be the case. I mean, I think people are just really frightened about coming to the marketplace to see what's available because they automatically assume there's no way it's going to be affordable. They hear the percentage of the increases that were to come on their premiums, and it keeps them away from just coming and taking a look at it.
Right.
But it is true that subsidies are out there. They are still available. The same subsidies, two subsidies that were available last year on the marketplace, are still there and available for folks.
Mm-hmm. Now, a federal judge recently upheld the president's plan to stop funding the subsidies to cover out-of-pocket costs for millions of people with affordable Care Act plans. Explain that. I mean, what's the impact of that? What does this mean for enrollees?
Well, my understanding is that although he did stop that, those insurance companies are still passing on the savings in the form of what's called a cost-sharing reduction. That is the name of that particular subsidy you're referencing. And those cost-sharing reductions are still available for the consumers, but my understanding is that the insurance company is just not being reimbursed for that subsidy from the government any longer.
Okay, but you can be assured of that subsidy for the next year if you enroll, I would assume.
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when you're enrolling, it's not like you're going to enroll, get certain conditions, and then political changes happen in Washington, and then, whoops, sorry, these three things are completely different now in your plan.
Yes, my understanding is that, you know, contracts have been signed and plans are laid out for the calendar year, and that what goes in effect January 1 should remain in effect until December 31st, 2018.
Okay, join us with your questions. If you're on the health insurance marketplace, going to healthcare.gov, Nicole Cook is with us to answer your questions. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Laura Belin is with us. Laura, are you there?
I'm here. The name is Belin.
Belin, sorry. Laura, tell us, you're buying insurance on through healthcare.gov. Tell me about your situation.
Well, we were Wellmark customers for more than 10 years. We switched when the Affordable Care Act was implemented. We were able to find a plan on the marketplace that was a better deal through the nonprofit co-op, Co-Opportunity Health. That failed after a year, largely because Congress cut the funding, the federal funding that was supposed to support those nonprofit insurance co-ops. So at that point, we moved to a Coventry policy. Mm-hmm. And then for this past year, we've been on an Aetna policy because Aetna took over Coventry. But since Aetna is not going to be selling individual insurance in Iowa next year, we are going to be looking at Medica. And I had asked Wellmark whether we could buy back into one of their plans. And even though we were Wellmark customers for, like I said, more than a decade, they aren't letting any customers back on their plans. You have to have been a continuous Wellmark customer. And I think that's a story that's not getting a lot of attention, is how Wellmark Blue Cross Blue Shield has sabotaged the healthy functioning of Iowa's individual health insurance market exchange.
Mm-hmm. Laura, there, oh, I didn't mention at the outset, I wanted to mention too, just in the interest of transparency, you're a blogger for Bleeding Heartland, which is a progressive blog. Nicole Cook, talk about that, the problem that Laura faced there.
Yes, you know, Laura wasn't alone in what she experienced with working through all the different insurers over the years on the marketplace. It's been a rough ride. It's been confusing to folks, and it's really disheartening once you get in a plan and with a company that you're excited about, like Co-Opportunity Health, mm-hmm. That we had, and then to have that sort of taken away or canceled. You know, It has been a bit of a roller coaster for folks, and I really feel bad for folks that are in that position and have had to go through that. You know, what I can say, though, is that Medica has been on the marketplace for a few years now on healthcare.gov, and they are also a nonprofit health insurance company, and they've done really well. I think most people are very happy with the experience that they've had with Medica, but if you, like Laura, have been with multiple insurers, and, you know, I'm sure that could put a bit of a bad taste in your mouth to come back. But I can't say enough. We just really want folks to get to the marketplace and take a look and see what's out there. I think they might be pleasantly surprised.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the issues is that, well, there are only two states in the country where the Blue Cross Blue Shield has chosen not to offer policies on the individual exchange, and one of them is Iowa. So that's one problem, that Wellmark is really not operating in good faith. The other issue is that Wellmark has about 100,000 people locked into these old plans that are called either grandfathered or grandmothered plans, and these are insurance policies that they could sell before the Affordable Care Act was fully implemented, so they could still screen out people who had pre-existing conditions. So one of the reasons why Medica's rates are so high is because the people who are stuck buying on the individual market are locked out of these Wellmark plans, and as a group, they are a sicker, more expensive group of people to insure. And that's one thing that's been keeping other companies out of Iowa, is because they're not seeing a way to make a profit here, because so many of the healthy people are locked into these Wellmark plans that are cheaper because they don't fully comply with the Affordable Care Act.
Laura, in your specific case, well, you have until December 15th to enroll. Are you seeing your way forward? I noticed, you know,
well,
there's some confusion. Are you going to find your way through? Do you see light at the end?
Well, we're going to get a policy one way or another. I mean, our rate, when I looked on the Medica website, the top line premium is more than double what we've been paying Aetna. What I don't know is whether we're going to qualify for subsidies this year. Our income fluctuates from year to year, so I don't know whether we will qualify. And I think that it's a very important point that Nicole raised, that I think a lot of people don't understand, is that top line price that they see on the website isn't necessarily what they have to pay.
Right.
So, but I don't know yet. I mean, it's definitely going to go up substantially. I mean, we're not going to go uninsured. I'm not going to roll the dice on being uninsured, but we're going to have to make probably some other significant changes in our household budget to be able to swing this thing.
Okay, Laura Bellin, thank you for sharing your individual case. We want to get to a number of other Iowans who are seeking insurance as this new enrollment program period begins. The changes there. Rebecca is with us in Tiffin. Hi, Rebecca. What's your situation? What are you looking at?
Well, my husband and I are we own our own small business in the Iowa City area, and we're both employed by that business, so we have to provide our own insurance. We do make too much for subsidies, and currently we're on one of those grandfather's plans that are hurting everybody else. But for me, I have one daughter and I would like another, and the grandfathered plan doesn't cover anything as far as that goes. So I was looking at the marketplace, and without subsidies, my cheapest plan is $600 a month just for me, and doesn't include treatment for infertility, or the infertility treatment is like a 40% coinsurance or something. So I just can't afford. We make enough to not get subsidies, but not enough to actually afford unsubsidized insurance, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Nicole.
We looked into.
Just have Nicole, small business. Right. Just
and
to have Nicole.
It's not offered.
Right. Nicole, jump in here and talk about the people who are here, what, in the middle? Not, they can't qualify for subsidies?
Yeah.
They fall through a crack here.
Yes. You know, we're aware that there is a certain group of folks that are going to really struggle with this. And it's really difficult when you're self-employed and, you know, sometimes aren't even able to predict or project your income for the next year, which is a requirement in order to try to qualify for these subsidies on the marketplace. So not only is it extremely difficult to do that when you're self-employed, but also, you know, if you, like Rebecca, are in an income bracket that puts you above the income level to qualify for subsidy, then you're paying full price premiums. And when you have a family or an individual who's looking at full price premiums, it is extremely expensive and not necessarily affordable. And those folks are the ones hurting from those premium increases versus the same family that would qualify for a tax subsidy for the marketplace, and that subsidy absorbing the most of the increase there.
Nicole Cook is a navigator for health insurance, a navigator with Visiting Nurse Services of Iowa. There are actually cuts. The Trump administration made huge cuts to marketing, consumer assistance. You fall into that category, I think, Nicole.
We do.
The Trump administration officials questioned whether the millions on marketing and assisting, such as through navigators, with this open enrollment, was making a difference. So it cuts by up to 90%. So Iowa's navigators,
yes.
how many of you are there in the state helping out? How many thousand people?
I know. You know, previous years we've had three grantee organizations within the state of Iowa. It's been Visiting Nurse Services of Iowa, my organization, Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, and Genesis, that covered the whole state of Iowa, all 99 counties. This year, because of all of those budget cuts and a huge 90%, I think over 90% reduction in advertising funds, we're left with only three licensed navigators that offer free in-person assistance to folks throughout the whole state of Iowa. And our organization, Visiting Nurse Services, we only cover, a fraction of the counties that we have in Iowa. And so it's unfortunate because not only are we getting mixed messages from the political spectrum about what is actually available to folks this year, and then the stopgap measure was something that was thrown in as a potential option. And so there's lots of mixed messages, and we don't have the advertising dollars to be able to set the record straight and to let the public know what's here and who's here to help.
Okay, let's go back. We have just about 5 minutes left. Quickly, we'll go to Katie in Des Moines. Please be brief, Katie, but what's your situation? Welcome. Katie, are you there? Okay, Katie's not there. Let's go to Stefan Hansen. Stefan Hansen, you are in the market for health insurance. Hi.
Hey, guys. We are. And I honestly haven't had too much time to look at it quite yet. I did look a little bit this morning, but it looks like the plan that came out for us is around $1,400 a month, which, I mean, in my mind, is just crazy. I got to say,
$1,400 a month for your family. How many? Yeah.
Yeah, that's without any, like, subsidies or anything. And I'm also self-employed, so sort of in the same boat where it's, like, you know, close to impossible to estimate sort of what I'll be making next year. I got to say, I'm from Denmark, so I've seen the light of, you know, universal health care.
Denmark has had universal health coverage there forever and a day, haven't they?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing, which maybe is a little bit too broad for this topic, but, you know, seeing, having to pay all this money, like, there's a reason I had to go to the doctor, and, like, they said, you know, we should test, and it was a urology test, and it was very unpleasant, but, you know, I was sort of thinking as it was coming up, I'm trying to think of, well, you know, can I sort of get out of this? Is it going to be expensive? But, you know, went ahead, and everything was okay, but, you know, then getting a bill 2 weeks later for $1,000 still, even with having insurance, just sort of blows my mind. You know, I don't think people should have to decide between, you know, do I want to find out if there's something wrong with me or do I have $1,000 later on?
Right. So what you're looking at is a premium of $1,400 a month and then actually insurance that requires that's not the greatest coverage?
Correct, yeah.
Oh, a comment on that, Nicole, what the situation is there for Stefan.
Yeah, you know, that's the important thing to realize is that we're talking about monthly premiums here, but that doesn't take care of all of your expenses with a health care plan. You know, the monthly premium is just a portion of your responsibility. So on top of those monthly premiums that folks are having to make, we've got deductibles that potentially you might be meeting or having to meet within that service realm. We have out-of-pocket maximums, and then you've got co-payments that you might have to pay when you go to a provider's office, a primary care doctor or a specialist. And then we have co-insurance, which is the percentage of the charges that you will be responsible for as the insuree. So, you know, premiums are just a small portion. But there's other things that we have to look at in determining what plan might be right for you, you know, all of those things. So,
mm-hmm. Stefan, I wish you the best of luck in trying to find a suitable plan that's less than $1,400 a month and a good plan, but I'm sure you've asked yourself the what if here. What if you just can't afford coverage? Would it be enough to pull you and your family out of this country back to universal health coverage in Denmark?
I mean, I guess we're lucky enough that, you know, we have that option, but I realize a lot of people don't, you know. But yeah, I mean, if things went, you know, south, then sure, yeah, we could always do that, mm-hmm. which is nice. But
yeah, right.
Of course, you know, we prefer to stay here if we can.
Right. Before you came here, very quickly, before we let you go, since you have this unique experience in Denmark, you know, we hear various press reports. I'm sure you've seen them about, you know, universal health care coverage and satisfaction or dissatisfaction. Were you or are Danes generally satisfied with the health care you have there, universal health care?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, of course, you pay higher taxes, but, you know, it's just one thing that you don't have to worry about as a family, especially with kids, you know. Right. And, you know, going through that process every year, and of course, it's gotten easier over the last couple of years with the marketplace, but, you know, we've had to switch providers like twice, so it's new doctors, and, you know, it's just something you don't have to think about. I don't think anybody that, you know, gets seriously sick should have to, like, you know, go through that process, really.
Right, right. And if I understand right, other European countries, the health insurance is decoupled from employers. We are so used to in this country saying mm-hmm. Taking a job, not taking a job based on the health benefits. There, it's completely independent, right?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay. Stefan, thanks for your view. Good luck finding a health insurance plan.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Finishing up with Nicole Cook, our navigator with Visiting Nurse Services of Iowa. We have two or three minutes left here. I don't know what's the best thing to get out here. The biggest misconception right now with all this confusion out there, and I think you emphasized it at the start of our conversation, is you've got to go there to find out what you could get. And don't get disheartened by news you hear here or in any other news source, right?
That's right, Ben. Really, the important message here is to get on the website healthcare.gov or call the healthcare.gov website. They have an 800 toll-free number. They're 24/7. They represent 150 languages. Folks can also contact Visiting Nurse Services of Iowa. Our local number is 515-288-1516. Us navigators offer free in-person assistance, impartial assistance in helping them complete the enrollment process, shop and compare for plans. And then you have to get out there and take a look and see what's available. I think people are going to be pleasantly surprised. And then the other message is really just to let them know the marketplace is here. We've got an insurer that's committed to Iowans for 2018, and to come and take a look.
Right. And the other message, too, that's worth emphasizing, Nicole, is it reminds me, we say, don't just assume that initial sticker price is what you'll be paying, right? It's like
That's correct.
It reminds me a little bit, if I can make this parallel, to like, you know, searching for a college for a young kid. You don't just look at the tuition and board. You look at the entire package to see what's coming back at you, right?
Exactly. You know, premiums, what your portion of your premium that you're responsible for is going to be figured based on if you qualify for a subsidy or not. So, you know, the subsidy that you qualify for may be quite generous, and even more generous maybe than in years past. So it's really important to get onto healthcare.gov or call the marketplace and fill out that application for coverage. That application for coverage will tell the consumer, yes, you qualify for a subsidy and how much that subsidy is, and then you can take that information looking at the plans and moving forward.
Mm-hmm. We only have a minute left, but talk to me, your impression of this shortened period, only 45 days of enrollment till December 15th,
yes.
Half the time consumers had last year. Does that shortened work period change the work of you navigators?
It sure does. In light of the loss of all of the funding and the subsequent loss of all of the local in-person assisters, other navigators from other agencies like myself, you know, it's been really tough to reach folks. And having the shortened enrollment period, it's hard to get all of our events and serve all of our counties in that time. But we are doing the best we can. We are here, and we're working hard to assist any Iowans that need help in this process. And we're just really happy to still be here and providing services to our community and our state.
We're happy to have had you on for this half hour. Nicole Cook, navigator with Visiting Nurse Services of Iowa. Nicole, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Coming up after we take a short break, does power posing really boost your confidence? What about that idea of, well, you feel crummy? Why not smile and it will kind of inhabit your body, make you feel happier? We'll talk with a psychologist about whether that's actually true. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Does power posing really boost your confidence? How about smiling? We know that when you're happy, you smile, but what about the reverse? If you smile, does it make you happy? And does breastfeeding produce more sensitive mothers? Perhaps you've heard all of these in the press, psychological studies. This half hour, we want to talk about how famous psychological findings may or may not hold up to scrutiny, and how psychological studies are portrayed in the media. Joining us this half hour to do that is Susan Wagner Cook. She is Associate Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences at the University of Iowa. Susan, welcome to our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's get into this, because these are some of the things that we find in our popular press that are also reported on public media as well, things floating around there that some people believe in. Let's tackle the power posing. So this is this is okay, power pose, a good power pose. Let me just say, we ask people, if you're not in your car driving or like in your kitchen with a sharp object, you can put it down and put your hands on your hips and you widen your stance. That's what we're going to do. We're going to be do that, the Wonder Woman stance.
Wonder Woman, take up space, make your body big.
Big. And
you own the space.
There you go. Okay, so that's probably the most popular power pose. Now we ask ourselves, do we feel bolder? Is it supposed to take effect immediately? I don't know.
Usually in these studies, people are holding the pose for 1 to 2 minutes, so not a long time, but not instantaneously. It takes a little time, I think, to sink in.
Okay. Tell us about the study that this is rooted in, or studies. Perhaps there's been more than one.
So the original work was by Amy Cuddy of Harvard University, and she did a study that showed that holding these poses for 2 minutes, I think, actually not only increased participants' feeling of power, but also had effects on their hormones. So suggesting, I think, increased testosterone levels. I'm trying to remember the specific hormone. But so basically that it had some sort of biological influence on what was going on inside the body, and that then was thought to make people feel more confident, more powerful, could change behavior, help people in situations where they might feel threatened or nervous or things like that.
Well, it sounds logical to me. I'll buy it, but maybe I shouldn't. What? Throw in the skeptic here. Is this questionable? Does this hold up?
The original work was really exciting. People were very interested. Amy Cuddy had a TED Talk on it that was wildly popular, one of the most successful TED Talks of all time. Although then when people started digging into the specific research, they noticed that the sample sizes were small, that the analysis of the hormones didn't really follow established principles, and maybe there was some weakness in how the study was designed and reported, and maybe the effects didn't hold up. And there has since been a large version of this study, a replication where they recruited a lot of participants, and they didn't find evidence for any hormonal effects of power posing.
Okay, so what are we left? I mean, power posing can't hurt you.
It can't hurt you. So they also didn't find evidence for a big behavioral effect. So
right. There's
some debate right now. Does power posing influence how you say you feel? And there's some evidence that it does, some that it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think overall, most people are not convinced that this is going to change people's lives or help them ace that job interview or something like that.
Okay, so let's say there's someone out there has been doing power poses, getting up in the morning, tackling the day, and it's been working great for them. They do their power poses. It's been working great. So there's perhaps other psychological things that work then, because you're what, over a period of months or years, associating a good start to the day with a power pose, and then that's something different, but it works then, right?
Yeah, and maybe even just taking a few moments to pause and not think about anything helps you relax and then helps you do better. So it might not be about the specific pose, but merely, although in the original research, they manipulated the poses that people did. The trick is, I mean, if it works for you, you can keep doing it. Should we recommend it for the broader population? Probably not.
I wonder if there have been any studies on, I don't know, what is the, I'm trying to think of, what is the power pose, the meek pose?
Well, you kind of huddle down, bring everything in, take up as little space as possible.
Yeah, exactly, right. You don't look threatening, you don't look powerful. Do we know anything about that?
Well, that was actually the control condition in these studies. So one group would assume these powerful poses, another group would assume these more meek poses, and then you would show that there were differences.
I would buy that, though, because if I think, okay, I'm feeling great, and then somebody says, now you're going to get into a weak pose and stay there, kind of just hammers a little on your psyche, doesn't it? I don't know.
It does, but that's kind of the trick of doing science. Just because it makes sense and you might believe it doesn't mean that it's true, right?
Right. Okay. So this may be something we never know, or do you think we will get to the end of power posing?
I think we will get to the bottom, in part because in this particular example, people are invested. It's been kind of the test case for, is the psychological literature reliable? And so I think people are vested in answering this question. I do think in other cases, we won't always know for sure.
Okay. Let's talk about smiling. We know that feeling happy makes us smile. That's just the way we're wired, right? But can smiling when we're down, for instance, or just not in a great mood, forcing yourself to smile, and we've heard this as a bunch of advice. Well, if you're not happy, why don't you just act happy and it will turn you into a happier person. What's the research there? Where does this go back to? What kind of study?
This goes all the way back to Darwin, who hypothesized that, you know, the facial expressions that we make when we experience emotions become associated to those emotions and feed back and actually influence our emotional state. So if you force yourself to smile, Darwin believed you would feel happier. The trick is, if you tell somebody to smile and they feel happier, you don't know whether it's just that they kind of know what you're asking. It's kind of hard to be sure that it's really, you know, it's obvious to a participant what you're doing. And so researchers tried to figure out ways to get people to smile without telling them to smile. And specifically, they wanted to do it really cleverly, make them smile, but they didn't even know that they were smiling. And that's where the work by Fritz Stark, I think, and I'm blanking on his last name, he came up with this clever way of getting people to smile or not. And so he had people either hold a pen crosswise in their lips, which pulls your muscles back like you're smiling, or he had people hold a pen kind of pointing out from your mouth, which then does not make you smile.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they were watching films and they had to assess how enjoyable these films were. And they were also asked, you know, about, you know, the facial expression that they were making to detect if they figured out that they were smiling and then kind of figured out the work. And then in the original study, what they found is that the participants who had the pen crosswise in their lips were more amused by the film clips that they were watching. So, and they also didn't realize that they were smiling. So it looked like the structure of your facial expression, even unbeknownst to you, feeds back and influences how you feel.
And is that true?
So, probably not. So it turns out the original work was not very well done. It had a very small sample sizes and borderline effects. There has since been a large multi-lab. So 17 different labs tried to reproduce this effect using the same basic procedure supported by the original researcher. And 9 of the labs found that smiling helped. Made things more amusing. 8 of the labs found smiling didn't make things more amusing.
It's a toss-up.
It's a toss-up, so it doesn't really seem to hold up.
Oh, I want to remind our listeners that joining us this half hour, we're talking about with Susan Wagner-Cook of the University of Iowa, where she's Associate Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences. We're talking about maybe some pop psychology, if we can put it in that category. Pop psychology studies, power posing, smiling when you don't feel good. If those really work, if they are, you know, hold up to scrutiny. Back to this, to the smiling before we move on, you know, a trick that we use, or sort of a tool, let's say, that we use in public radio when we have young people learning to read copy, read the news, read something so that it's interesting for the ears rather than sounding red, is an interesting one that relates to this. Is often you'll give them something to read and you say, they'll read it, and it will sound kind of monotone and dull, and say, read it again, but make sure you're smiling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how that will brighten up someone's voice, make their voice more interesting and more friendly. I wonder if that ties in here.
Well, that's a great research question. I'd love to know the answer to that. We certainly can hear smiles in people's voices, right?
Even right. I see you're smiling right now.
And you know, you're listening on the radio, you have a sense. And so something does change in your voice. But in those cases, again, you know you're smiling. And that's a little bit different than the idea that if you somehow got people to structure their face in that same way, it would have the same effect versus knowing that you're in this state.
Right. When we're telling someone to smile, we're not saying, okay, move your muscles so that you're...
Pull the corners of your mouth back. And
you're essentially saying, sound happier, right? Sound brighter, sound happier, sound more enthusiastic. So, it gets down to the language there. So, okay, we can... All right, okay. Well, interesting that it goes back to Charles Darwin. Let's move on to another one. This one, I guess I haven't heard that much about. Breastfeeding producing more sensitive mothers. This goes back to a study when?
This was a study that just came out, I think, earlier this week, actually. So
okay.
maybe
that's
why you haven't,
heard so much about it.
It, but certainly a hot topic, I think, these days, and one that a lot of people are interested in.
So what does the study say?
So this study looked at an analysis of a large sample, I think on the order of 11,000 moms who were collected as part of a longitudinal data set, data collected starting in like 1991. And what they did is they assessed moms interacting with their babies and dads interacting with their babies every 3 months throughout the first couple years of life. And at the same time, they also asked these moms a variety of questions, some of which related to their breastfeeding status. Had they ever breastfed? How long were they breastfeeding? And so what the researchers today were doing was going back and looking at this data and trying to figure out, was there a relationship between whether or not the moms were breastfeeding and how long they were breastfeeding for with the sensitivity that they displayed in these parent-child interactions.
So how are we defining sensitivity, do you know, in this
so
case?
So they gave, it varied a little bit by age of the child. So one example they used was this Etch-a-Sketch task where parents and a parent and a child, like a 3 or 4 year old, are sitting at a table with an Etch-a-Sketch and there's a maze overlaid on the Etch-a-Sketch.
Mm-hmm.
And the parent has one knob and the child has the other knob and they have to work together to solve the maze.
Ooh, that sounds like fun.
It is fun. You have to communicate and coordinate. And there's some evidence that parents and children who are, you know, sensitive to each other are able to do a better job at solving this sort of maze, at working together.
So you can talk. You're allowed to talk. You don't have to make, I mean, when you're doing the Etch-a-Sketch yep. thing.
Well, in some versions you can talk, in other versions you can't. But I don't know the specific version used in this data set. I'm guessing it was a talking one. But that's just one example. They had a variety of tasks across ages where parents would be interacting with their children, and then they would video record that and offline score the sensitivity. So assess when the child does something, is the parent responsive or not, and get a measure of how sensitive they were.
Mm-hmm. And the conclusion of this study was?
So what they found is that the parents who breastfed longer, well, actually the moms who breastfed longer, showed increasing sensitivity over time. And they were controlling for a lot of other characteristics of those moms, like their education level, whether they had a partner in the home, the mom's own neuroticism. And so they didn't see the same effect for dads, which is nice because then that provides a hint more evidence that it might really be about breastfeeding. But so in this kind of pretty complex statistical model, when the longer moms breastfed, the more their sensitivity increased as the child grew up.
Hmm. Okay. How solid? It's a new study. So
it has a nice big sample. You know, a lot of the other studies that we've talked about have small samples for the initial finding, which, you know, and if you only are basing your results on a few people, it's more likely that you're going to go wrong. The more data points you have, the better. So this is based on a nice large sample. The measures are really nice. They have a nice statistical model. And so those are all strengths of the study. I think this is high quality research. That being said, I'm still somewhat skeptical of their conclusions for a couple of reasons. The first is that there was a lot of attrition. So by the end of the study, about, I think, 27% of the families were no longer in the study. And those moms were different than the moms who stayed in the study. And so that makes it harder to generalize from this sample to the population more broadly, because we know we're only studying moms who will stay in the study for, you know, however many years and keep participating, and not moms in general.
Mm-hmm.
The second, there's two other things that make me a little bit skeptical of this finding. The second is that, of course, moms themselves are choosing in some way whether or not they're breastfeeding. So you're not able to randomly assign people to different groups. And so there could be other things about moms. Maybe moms who are increasing in sensitivity are more likely to keep breastfeeding. And it's not that the breastfeeding is causing the increase in sensitivity, but it's something else about the mom.
Hmm.
And you can't really disentangle this. They try to do that statistically, but it's a problem for studying things like breastfeeding, where you don't get to tell people whether or not and for how long they breastfeed. They get to decide themselves. And there are a lot of characteristics of people that are going to influence that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing I would say, I think the findings are interesting, but the time is different. These data were collected in 1991. Do we know that, you know, the characteristics that made a mom breastfeed in 1991 are the same as what happens today?
Right.
And I think the lives of families change, how we think about caregiving changes over time. And so even if it's true that moms in 1991 who breastfed longer became more sensitive, it doesn't necessarily mean that moms today who breastfeed longer are going to become more sensitive moms.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So, you're our pop psychology skeptic.
I have turned into a skeptic, but I mean, that's the job of a scientist.
And skeptic in the most the positive way. We need skeptics. We don't want to just accept things. Now, I imagine I'm just trying to imagine through your eyes, you know, we have studies every week. Several studies as public radio listeners were consuming these and other media as well. They're all over the place. Help us put on some sort of viewers, glasses, if you will, that we can better evaluate what's out there so that we don't, let's say, I don't know, hopping on one foot will make me a better person or a more generous person, says a study. I go off hopping on one foot most of the day.
Well, you'll get stronger in one leg, right?
Right. Yeah, well, How do I know if it's worth it to do that?
So, for example, the breastfeeding study, I do think it's a good study. It's well done. It gives us a little bit of evidence that there might be something to this, but it's a really hard thing to study. It's, you know, one example, and there are some problems with it. And so it's a case where that has maybe slightly increased my belief, but I'm not going to change my mind based on a single study. And so I think for any one study, I wouldn't change my mind or my behavior substantially based on any one study unless I saw evidence that that was a really high-quality study. And to be high quality, you need a large sample, you need some random assignment, you need pre-specified analysis plans, and you probably want to be building on a large literature. So I don't think anyone should rely on only one study.
Double-blind is good? You don't want your...
Double-blind is good, but not always possible, right?
Okay, double-blind, meaning, tell us what that means.
Meaning that the people who are telling participants what to do don't necessarily know what the hypothesis is, and the participants don't necessarily know kind of what condition they're in. So in medical studies, if you're taking a drug, the researcher will give you a pill and not know which pill you're receiving. You will also not know which pill you're receiving, and then your assessment of whether it's working isn't influenced by your knowledge of whether it's the treatment of interest versus the control group.
We only have about 3 minutes left, but time enough to have you talk about another one of these studies. I don't know if I've heard about this one. So this is exposure to words pertaining to aging will make you walk more slowly. Tell us about this study briefly.
So this is a classic finding, goes back to the 90s in social psychology, and really was the basis of a large literature for ways of manipulating people's thoughts and then their behavior. And the idea was that there were these really rich influences, and that thinking about things influenced all sorts of behaviors, even down the line. So I think this study was really compelling because it actually, the participants didn't even know that there was any relationship. So they first completed this task where they were exposed to words about aging. They then thought they were done with the experiment and were headed down the hall to a different experiment. And a research assistant was sitting there with a stopwatch, timing their walking as they just, you know, went to their next place. They didn't even realize it was still part of the experiment.
Okay,
at that
so
time.
The people in the group that were being tested, not the control group, were getting words like gray hair, arthritis,
exactly,
achy bones, or I don't know, things like that, things related to aging.
Mm-hmm.
So does this bear out scrutiny?
So this study is yet another one that has not held up to replication. So large-scale replication attempts have been unable to replicate this finding, suggesting that maybe there were some idiosyncrasies in the original samples or how the data were analyzed that led to these findings. Although I want to be clear and say I don't think it's not just psychology that has these problems. These are seen in a variety of fields. So cancer biology, economics, in general, scientists are realizing more about how flexibility in scientific practices can really cause problems in their inferences. And so we have to be more careful and do better quality research to be sure that we're finding the truth.
It seems to be worth mentioning that in this age of, well, skepticism about science in general, that this is something we have to really grapple with. If we have all these things that we think are scientifically based that are not, we might come to the conclusion that all science is junk.
Yeah, I mean, I believe in the scientific method, but scientists are people and they're susceptible themselves to biases and they have ideas and they want their experiments to work. And so we have to build into the system ways of checking our own cognitive biases to make sure that we actually are appropriately applying the scientific method to find out what's true.
In the final seconds, I'm putting you on the spot, Susan. Can you give us one psychological study that is really foolproof that I can practice today, anybody can practice today, doing something to improve my life, myself?
So I'll use one from my own research, because why
yes.
not? I study the hand gestures that we use when we communicate, and it turns out that if you gesture more, your listener is more likely to understand what you're saying. And I'm pretty confident that that's true.
I do that anyway.
I'm positive it will help children learn math.
Gesturing so. More makes you more articulate.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Susan Wagner-Cook, thank you very much. I'd love to have you back sometime to be our pop psychology skeptic, sort out what's founded from unfounded or kind of in between. Susan Wagner-Cook, Associate Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming into our studio.
Thanks so much for having me.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon with help from Robbie Broad. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.